Welcome to the Future of Resolution, Miles Mediation and Arbitration's podcast.
I'm your host, Chris Smith, but everyone here just calls me Smitty. When I'm not podcasting, I work as a mediator with Miles in our Savannah office. I'm coming at you today from beautiful downtown Savannah, where it's a sunny 82 degrees. Looking out my window here, I see a bunch of tourists on trolleys who appear to never have heard of the coronavirus. So it seems that people are ready to get back to play. But are they ready to get back to work? That will be our topic for discussion today. And incidentally, everyone, Miles is pleased to announce that our offices will be back open for in-person ADR starting on June 1st in Savannah, Atlanta, and our Charlotte offices. So be sure to come see us. And if you're not ready yet to venture back into the conference room, that's okay. We'll still be offering all of our services virtually on Zoom. Now, as great as Zoom is, as a litigator, I miss my friends and colleagues here in town. So I'm thrilled that my two guests are actually here with me, in person, sitting at a socially acceptable 6 feet apart, of course. Welcome Sarah Lamar and Wade Herring. I'm delighted to have you guys on tonight's show. Now, Wade is a partner at the Savannah office of Hunter McLean. Representing businesses and management, Wade's practice focuses on all aspects of employment problems and issues, including internal employment practices, wage hour issues, drug testing, sexual harassment, equal employment opportunity, the Americans with Disability Act, and employee benefits. He is the past president of the Savannah Bar Association and an alumni of Dartmouth University, which I understand was recently named one of the top 8 Ivy League schools. Now, of course, Wade, I'm only joking. He's got a great sense of humor. He's actually a regular presenter at TEDx. Now, Wade, other than your recent shave, what's new with you?
Well, I've been living COVID-19 since about March 18. Went to bed on St. Patrick's Day night, realizing that I probably would not have a college reunion this summer. And the next morning, I think every tourist-related business in Savannah realized we were in for a long, hard haul and started calling lawyers and other resources about what do we do to figure this out.
And then your phone started ringing off the hook.
It did. And I've learned a lot more about viruses than I ever thought I would as a lawyer. Dealt with face masks and gloves and FICRA and all kinds of issues, both legal and medical, that March 18, I would have never predicted. In fact, anyone who did a 5-year plan in 2015 got it wrong.
Well, we're happy to have you here tonight to hopefully untangle some of those mysteries for us. My other guest is another Ivy League grad, Sarah Lamar. She is a partner in Hunter McLean's Savannah office and practices in the area of employment law. She has experience representing employers in employment litigation in state and federal courts regarding discrimination in employment laws such as Title VII, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, Family and Medical Leave Act, and Fair Labor Standards Act, among others. She also represents employers in breach of contract actions, including non-competes and tort claims, as well as in agency investigations brought by the U.S. and Georgia Departments of Labor and the EEOC. Sarah regularly conducts in-house training for employers and advises clients on a variety of human resource issues, including their federal affirmative action and immigration law obligations. Now, Sarah, it turns out we have two things in common. First, we've both got twins at home. Now, I'm sure your quarantine has been easy and restful. How's your Sam's Club bill?
My Sam's Club bill, Smitty, is very, very high.
Robust.
And it is robust, and every time when I go and spend too much money, most of the food's gone within about 2.5 days.
I know the feeling. Now, of all coincidences, your dad was actually my dad's professor at Yale. How crazy is that?
That is totally crazy, and we never would have known it had we not worked together.
That is great. My dad always talked about how much he liked Professor Lamar. Well, thank you both for joining me tonight, and we'll get down to business. People are coming back to work. Employees don't know what to do. Employers don't know what to do. I was hoping that you two could help tell some of our listeners what they can do. Sarah, as businesses in the state reopen and employees are being asked to return to work, what are some of the big issues you're seeing from an employment law perspective?
Well, Smitty, one of the biggest areas of concern is continued unemployment compensation benefits. So when so many employees were furloughed and laid off permanently or temporarily in March and April, they were generously granted unemployment benefits. But as employers begin to try to reopen and contact those employees to come back to work, some employees are saying, not so fast. So some are saying not so fast because they're worried about their own health, or they live with someone who's in a fragile, vulnerable health condition, and they don't want to expose that person. And others say not so fast because they really like the unemployment compensation they're getting, especially the $600 weekly booster from the feds that came with the CARES Act and other legislation.
Is that set to expire anytime soon?
It is currently set to expire at the end of July, but there's a lot of discussion if Congress gets its act together as to whether that will be continued. So there is an issue there with employers in various different industries who don't seem to be able to offer their employees enough money or incentive to come back to work in this environment while employees are getting their unemployment compensation benefits. So whether employees are still entitled to unemployment comp, if so, how much should the employer file for them, or should they file on their own, or has been an issue.
Yeah, I understand from talking with a lot of my friends in the restaurant industry that that has been an issue with some of their employees returning to work.
And for that's exactly right. And for those employees who simply say, I'd like to keep on my unemployment comp benefits, the U.S. Department of Labor has warned that only if you quit work with good cause are you entitled to benefits, and it will not tolerate any fraud of the unemployment compensation system. As part of the Federal CARES Act, Congress set aside $26 million to carry out audits and investigations of fraud. That seems like a lot of money, but maybe it's not so much money.
Now, what is this good cause? How is that defined?
Well, a good cause could include if you're infected with COVID-19. I think all of us would agree that that would be good cause not to come back to work. Having a family member that is infected, having to care for a child whose school is closed due to the pandemic, are just a few reasons that are legitimate. But if an employee simply says, I don't want to come back, please keep me on unemployment, that's really not a good reason. And the employer at that point ought to be saying, okay, I'm no longer going to file for partial unemployment benefits for you. You're on your own. And that will result in the employee having to go to the Department of Labor and say, I should get unemployment for the following reasons. And just, Smitty, one recent development on this issue is worth mentioning. Last Friday, the Georgia Department of Labor sent an email blast out to all employers with employees on unemployment comp, talking about how to deal with converted unemployment comp claims. So as employers bring employees back to work, as they determine, okay, we're going to permanently discharge some employees, they gave some guidance on how to do that and whether the employer should continue to file on employees' behalf. And essentially, bottom line is, if someone quits for no good reason, or the employer determines that the employee ought to be permanently discharged, the employee is ultimately going to be responsible for filing their own claims.
Well, Wade, it seems Sarah has done her best Lee Corso impression with not so fast on behalf of the employers. What about an employee who declines work and they lose their unemployment benefits? But are there any exceptions to that you've seen?
Well, as businesses start to reopen under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, to distinguish it from the Fair Credit Reporting Act, we'll call it the Families First Act. There are some instances there where the employee is allowed to have leave, and not only leave, to have paid leave. So, for example, one of those is if the employee is under a quarantine order. And there are employees in the state of Georgia who are still under a quarantine order through June 12th. And that would be employees 65 and older and or employees with certain underlying conditions such as diabetes, morbid obesity, liver disease, lung disease, et cetera. There's a list in Governor Kemp's executive order. And again, that's in place now through June the 12th. And my advice to employers is you need to honor the governor's order, even in those instances where maybe an employee says, I'm willing to come back to work anyway, because I've had that happen also. Another big issue as employers reopen is the issue of child care. Most schools in our area are closing or close to closing. But the options that parents had for the summer, many of those are not going to be there. There will not be the summer camps, day camp or overnight camp. There will not be the various child care options through churches and other entities like that. And so if that child is younger than 14, that's a qualifying reason for the parent to stay home and to get this paid leave. I'm urging my clients to have straightforward conversations with their employees. If it's a two-parent home, is there some way you can juggle schedules? Is there a way to do intermittent leave? Is there a way to allow that employee to work from home? Of course, in the hospitality industry, that's usually not going to be the case. So there's some options there. We're getting situations where employees say they're scared to come back to work. That will not be sufficient. The employee does need to have a consultation with a healthcare provider. But all they have to do under the Families First Act is to provide the name of the healthcare provider that instructed them to quarantine in place. The employer's ability to demand documentation is extremely limited. Importantly, the sick leave part of the Families First Act is only for 2 weeks. It's the child care part that extends up to 12 weeks, and then it's only two-thirds of pay and up to $200 a day, and it maxes out at $2,000. So there's some caps on that. And the way the employer gets repaid, so to speak, is through the tax credits through the IRS on payroll. But it'll be important that the employer documents in memo form in some way, here's why this person was put on paid leave, and here's why I'm claiming this tax credit. You don't turn it into the IRS, but you need to keep those records for at least the next 4 years. But when we were all shut down, no one was having to deal with these issues. Now that we're reopening, those are very real issues that employers are dealing with.
Certainly, I know that my wife and I face that. My wife is a lawyer as well. She wins all the arguments. But our kids normally have a summer of camps and other activities, and they're going to be at home, and someone's going to have to take care of them. And as you said, I think we'll work out some kind of arrangement where everyone chips in, and I think every other family is going to be under the same situation. What about a situation where you have one of these employees you just talked about with who might be in still a quarantine class, such as someone over the age of 65, and they want to come back to work? What does an employer do in that situation?
The position I've taken is that the employer tells that employee no. And number one, it is an executive order. That's the law. And lawyers are supposed to advise their clients about how to follow the law. Number two, we all feel terrible As an employer, if an employee came back to work before the order had expired and, God forbid, got critically ill or died. The other concern that I have about it, though, is a legal one in terms of legal risk. And that is if the employer and the employee act contrary to the order, that employee comes back to work. And again, God forbid, gets critically ill or dies. I can see this scenario where the group health insurance says, we're not covering it. That was work related. Workers' comp says, we're not covering it. That was an intentional act. And therefore, workers' comp isn't going to cover it. And I can see the beneficiaries, the spouse or the children, in the event of a death, saying, you know what? You intentionally violated an executive order of our governor, and therefore workers' comp is not a bar, and we're going to sue you in negligence and also intentional tort and seek punitive damages. So the health risk is big. The legal risk, in my opinion, is big. And, you know, June 12th is really just around the corner. I would keep those employees at home.
Wade, this is quite a situation. You're one of the smartest guys I know, and you trying to navigate through this, you know, just thinking of every employer out there trying to do what's right by their employees and comply with the law and keep everyone healthy. This is quite the hurdle.
It's very challenging, and it continues to evolve. The CDC guidance, which we lawyers would say that helps set the standard of care. It keeps changing. I represent some schools and some daycare schools. The guidance from the early child care department here in Georgia, it keeps changing. So if everything was status quo, it would be very confusing, but it's a constantly moving target. And of course, none of us alive have been through a global pandemic before. Sarah and I have both been reading the great influenza about the 1918-1919 pandemic. Very well written, perhaps not a way to relieve stress if you read it. But it's so we've got precedent in world history. We just haven't lived through it before. So, yes, it's very challenging for all of us, lawyers and businesses, employers, employees, parents, to keep up with what should we be doing legally, and more importantly, what's the right thing to do right now?
Well, Smitty, just jumping in here to Wade's point about the changing guidance, I mean, almost every single agency that an employer is supposed to follow has changed its guidance during the course of this pandemic.
What's OSHA up to these days?
Yeah, well, OSHA changed its guidance significantly, but on top of that, before I get to OSHA, the EEOC had guidance about COVID-19 and it and accommodating issues under COVID-19, and then it walked it back and then put out some new guidance. So it's not just OSHA, not just the Georgia Department of Labor, it's the EEOC, it's everybody. So the OSHA had in April released guidance that essentially said employers in the healthcare industry, emergency response organizations, and correctional institutions had to make work-related determinations of whether their employees had COVID-19 and had to record those or report those on various OSHA logs. So if someone who works in a hospital got COVID from a patient, the hospital, as the employer, had to record that as a work-related injury for OSHA purposes. On May 19th, so just a couple of days ago, they walked that back and said, now everybody has to do that, all employers. So not just the high-risk industries, everyone who has a COVID related injury or illness that's from work must record as a OSHA reportable injury. So how does the office employer or the non-healthcare, non-emergency responder determine that a positive COVID-19 case was work-related?
I was just going to ask you that same question. That seems quite difficult to determine.
I think it's going to be very difficult. Of course, the guidance was general and it would have to be based on the facts and circumstances at hand. OSHA generally said it would look at its compliance officers in any kind of investigation, would look at the reasonableness of the employer's investigation, the evidence available to the employer, the evidence that COVID-19 was contracted at work. So for most employers, that's going to be hard. Of course, if you're in a meatpacking plant and there are 50 employees working and 40 of them come down with COVID-19, I think probably that meatpacking employer is going to want to report that injury. But an office setting where one person comes down with COVID-19, no one else does. They recently went to New York before all this started and were with family who tested positive. I don't think the employer in that circumstance would necessarily have to report that instance.
Wade, is, what does the CDC have to say about all this?
Well, again, the CDC provides the guidance for reopening your workplace. And they've got it's a detailed website. One trick is when you do your Google search, you might limit the time scope under tools, because if you do a more restricted time search, you'll pull up the more recent CDC guidance. There was a lot of attention in the media about how a certain man in Washington didn't want the CDC to issue these detailed decision trees. They did issue that, but you can't find it unless you limit your time search to the last week, for example. So, but it's a lot of good information, and it's actually pretty easy to follow. It's pretty daunting, though, when you start thinking about opening up a business and, you know, what are the rules on face masks? What are the rules on distancing? What are the rules on cohorts of employees? And it gets even more complicated if you're talking about a camp or daycare or a school. One point I wanted to mention that ties into what we've been talking about. So the governor's order expires June the 12th. I don't think it will get extended. So after that, when employees want to come back to work, willingly or not, all these other laws that typically apply, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, all of those laws still apply. And I've had some clients tell me with all the best intentions that they intended to screen certain categories of employees before bringing them back to work. And my advice is no. That decision is between the employee and the employee's healthcare provider. Now, once that employee comes forward and says, employer, I have this condition, or I'm in this age category, or I'm pregnant, whatever it might be, then the employer has a duty to work with that employee to determine the validity of the request and whether or not there's a way to accommodate that employee. But the employer should not be making assumptions ahead of time for the employee, even with the best of intentions, and certainly not after the governor's order expires on June the 12th.
Hey, Smitty, can we talk about working from home for a second?
I was going to bring that up. It seems that that might be a direction that we're all heading in here shortly.
Well, ultimately, Wade touched on some points about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there may be some employees who say, I can't come to work, but I can work from home. And then the employer has to engage in that, what's called an interactive dialogue under the ADA, about whether that's a reasonable accommodation. And in some workplaces, that is not going to be reasonable to have to allow someone to work from home. And then you get into questions of, can you offer them leave, or do you make them come back to work? And in this COVID crisis, these are going to be really very challenging discussions, I think, with some employees. But for convenience only, an employee who just would rather work without pants on, you know, at home, that doesn't have to be accommodated. There has to be some reason, medical reason, once everything's opened up again, to excuse the person from coming to work. Unless, of course, the employer is fine with it and thinks everyone can be as productive working from home, with all those issues that come into play when you have people who actually aren't on site.
Smitty, and let me chime in. Once upon a time in HR, it was conventional wisdom that the way to stay out of trouble was to treat everyone exactly the same. I decided a while ago, quite frankly, that was not really true. But this crisis has really driven that point home, that employers are going to have to make case-by-case assessments with their employees about how to accommodate that employee's situation about working from home or modifying the schedule or putting them in an isolated place within the workspace. It's a myriad of fact-specific situations, but it does not, it absolutely does not mean treating everyone exactly the same. And to the extent that there's still HR people out there who think that's the answer, that's mistaken. And to the extent there are employees who are out there saying, well, you didn't do that for me. Well, yeah, we didn't do that for you because you're not 70 years old and you don't weigh 300 pounds. That's why we didn't do that for you.
Well, I think I read somewhere that they said 60% of the people would rather work from home. That's data is correct. Will we see everyone returning to work? You guys think most people will keep trying to work from home? What's the practical implication?
I've heard some recent news releases that certain insurance companies have closed regional or branch offices altogether.
Sure.
Because they've realized that, well, everyone can work from home. Why are we paying rent and utilities and office space for our workers? They can all work from home. I think it's not only industry specific, but I think it's also employer specific. It's what's your culture. And I think it's legitimate for an employer to have a culture that embraces collaboration and in-person interaction. But for other industries and employers, working from home is fantastic, and that works just fine.
Smitty, I'm old enough to have already lived through a cycle in HR world where companies shut down regional offices and set up home offices for people to work from home. That was in the late 80s into the early 90s, even really at the beginning of the technology revolution. And then both employees and employers said, you know what, there really is something special to working together and collaboratively monitoring people's performance and productivity. I think for the next few years, is there going to be a big change? I sure wouldn't want to be in the business of developing office space right now. But do I think that's permanent? I'm thinking not. I mean, we human beings are social creatures, and these trends are cyclical. But certainly for the immediate future, there's going to be a big change in the way we think about office space and working remotely.
Yeah, and I question the productivity of working from home compared to being in an office. all year long now, all quarantine long, both my children have been at home on both of our computers, and it makes working quite difficult, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners can identify with that. And of course, though, someone needs to be home with the children, and that you make accommodations to do so, and you do the best that you can. But as a litigator, I just need to be in the office collaborating with other attorneys and tossing ideas around. And, you know, it's a whole separate section on when are we going to get back to court? You know, is it a year from now? When are we going to get jury trials? When is lawyers going to be lawyers again? You know, it's going to be, it's just new ground for all of us. But I know the one question that, you know, everybody wants to know as a small business owner or a large business owner, I'm opening up my doors. I'm letting my employees back in. Am I about to get sued by everyone for getting the COVID virus? What are your guys' thoughts?
Well, I would say, Smitty, I recently did a little bit of research on lawsuits in Georgia as to COVID-related filings. And I didn't see any lawsuits brought by employees in this state against employers for COVID-related reasons. There were a fair number of lawsuits filed by inmates, by voting rights activists, and immigrants held in detention. So those are definitely already filed. A now somewhat famous case in Illinois, I think, is the first COVID employment case that has been filed, a real test case against Walmart, brought by two now deceased employees of Walmart. And in their complaint, they essentially said that Walmart knew that various employees had COVID-related symptoms, but negligently and willfully failed to clean the store adequately, did not enforce the use of masks or social distancing guidelines, failed to warn other employees of the COVID-19 symptoms of coworkers, and not implementing a disease response plan or infection prevention measures as suggested by the CDC and OSHA, among other things. So this case is early stages. We don't know how it's going to come out, but it really raises some fascinating kind of law school final exam questions about whether employers can be liable. And to Wade's point about the workers' comp exclusive remedy, can you get beyond that with claims of gross negligence? And what are the defenses of the employer to that? There could be many.
Well, I agree that I think that's a very challenging issue, and it's certainly a risk. Even as a defense lawyer, I'm usually in favor of letting the judicial system work things out when everything else has been tried. And that's how you're going to test this question. In the circumstances in which we find ourselves today, I think maybe Congress should do some legislation and at least give employers a grace period without being subject to the risk of a lawsuit. And every lawyer listening or every business owner listening knows that even if you've done nothing wrong, if you get sued, it's a huge consumption of time and energy and money and stress. And businesses need to be focusing all of those resources on how we get through this. Intellectually, it's very interesting if the vaccine is still a ways off, but they develop the antibodies test, and it looks like the antibodies, we will have immunity. You know, normally you would never, ever make employment decisions or any kind of decisions based on somebody's antibody status, but will we have to wear little badges, I got the antibodies, and then what's the fraud in that? If you fraudulently represent your antibody status, I mean, you go down that road, it's not hard to end up in a really weird place really, really fast.
and probably in an ADA lawsuit. That may be a different podcast, Smitty.
Well, Wade and Sarah, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You're two of the smartest lawyers I know, and you give real answers to real questions. And so, folks, when you get ready to go back to work, and you have any questions about employment law, be sure to ask Sarah or Wade and look them up at Hunter McLean with an A. And when you're ready to get back to mediation, please come see us over at Miles. As I said, we'll be opening for business in person on June 1st and open virtually throughout. In the meantime, stay healthy, stay safe, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
You've been listening to The Future of Resolution, the podcast. You can follow The Future of Resolution on Miles Mediation and Arbitration's Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and subscribe, rate, or review this podcast. Join us soon for another interesting discussion. Thank you for listening.